So, a welcome to Office Hour. As always, on Tuesday at 5 o'clock, first we remind you, you're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. And we also remind you that the views contained in this hour may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and I'm very happy to be back with you again today. And as always, we're going to go knock on a door. Can you hear us there? We're knocking on a door. We want to find out, what do all these people do on this campus? What do they do in all these big, beautiful buildings that have been built for us? What's happening inside these offices? What are people studying? What are they thinking about? And I'm very excited today that we have a very special guest, which is Ralph Hexter. So I want to say welcome, Ralph.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes. A man who wears many hats, but the hat he's wearing here is the researcher faculty hat and not the administrator hat, because one of the ideas, the models we've always had at the university is that administrators are faculty. Maybe faculty don't get quite into their research as much as they used to. Right?
Maybe not.
Maybe not, but they're still researchers. And we're going to be talking about all kinds of interesting stuff today about classics. Ralph Hexter has an appointment in both the classics and the comp lit department. So in addition to talking about classics, which I think many of you are familiar with the idea of what classics are, we're also going to be talking about comparative literature. And I think that raises a lot of interesting questions. How does classics fit into comparative literature? And Professor Hexter is a specialist on something called reception history. So if you've never heard of that term before, we're going to learn about that today. So, but as always, before we delve into particular articles, ideas, or research topics, we want to find out how this person found their way to studying ancient documents, classics, things that a lot of us wouldn't be willing to put all that time and energy into learning all those ancient languages. So how does someone become a scholar of classics? How do you become a scholar of classics? And then also a scholar of the reception, that is, the history of interpretation and study of the classics.
Well, I guess I'd go back to my childhood, and I was an avid reader. I had a very healthy imagination, and somehow I got very, very enchanted. This was long before the film The Lord of the Rings, but the Tolkien, actually the quartet, The Hobbit, and the trilogy. And I'm also, we may talk about it, I know you know this, I'm a big opera fan, and I was also at the same time very, very involved in studying and listening to Wagner's Ring of the Nibelungen. And so I can sort of give you two answers. First of all, now that I think back, one of my very earliest essays in comparative literature, even before I knew what that was a paper I wrote talking about how ideas from Norse and Germanic mythology in Wagner's Ring made their way also into Tolkien's Ring. But in any event, this may seem very odd, as odd as the Middle Earth, but when I went to college, my ambition was to become a professor of medieval literature.
Uh-huh.
And as you know, in some ways, I still am that. But to make a long story short, you need a number of languages for that. And though I had not studied Latin before, you definitely need Latin to be a medievalist. So I started Latin in college, and professor convinced me that it was not too late to do more in classics, which I found so interesting. So I studied Greek, and then I spent more time studying both of those languages and others, and that's how I got into classics as well as the other literatures I study.
Mm-hmm. I'm frequently impressed on this show by the power of the literature that children read. You're not the first story that of where faculty will come and talk about a story, a myth, a collection of children's stories they read that so fascinated them as a child that it ended up setting them on this life path. So I think that's something out there, all of your parent listeners. You might think about what you're giving your children to read and exposing them to a wide variety of different kinds of stories. But what you're saying also is that it wasn't until college that you really made the commitment to classics per se and did all that language learning for those students out there who are in that moment of thinking about in college, picking up their major.
Exactly. Well, I had started in our school system in French, and the pattern was if you were good at it, you just kept doing it. And I had already started and was making progress on German because, again, I knew even from my initial phase that to do this kind of scholarship, you need German, and Latin was next. And that's what decided me that I was going to do Greek. And I had very supportive parents. When I told my mom, I remember that, calling her up and telling her, well, I'm not going to do Italian next. I'm going to do ancient Greek. And I'm going to go do more years of study to really do the classics. She said, I wondered when you were going to get back to the classics.
Okay.
So I guess I would say, and one of the reasons I'm in comparative literature is once I study a language and read some of the literature, I just find it inevitable that I want to know more about the culture and the periods. And if you do that a few times, you start studying their interactions.
Mm-hmm. And you're comparing literature.
Exactly.
And there you are in comparative literature. So terrific. Well, again, parents out there, when your kids call up and say that they're doing Latin, we've learned now what you're supposed to say is, we thought you were going to be doing that, or what took you so long to get to Latin? So
exactly.
Terrific. Okay, now if we turn to the first of the many interesting articles that I want to try to get a chance to talk about today, this one is about Virgil's Homer. So just to bring everybody up to speed on what we're talking about how somebody read and made use of Homer many centuries after he wrote. There is Virgil in the first century before the Common Era. So Homer is already
at least 7 or 8 centuries. We're not even sure when Homer, or even if there was one Homer.
Right.
That's another story.
Right. But we're talking about really old literature. So someone is picking up and retelling and reusing and reshaping that story, much as the Homer. I was just happened today to be reading Alice Oswald's Memorial, which is a very recent retelling of Homer. So we know how much that has been retold over time. So what we see then is it's kind of interesting. We open up the window on the world of readers. We're really talking about readers because these are people who are in the first century before the Common Era, reading ancient texts. And one of the things you wrote, which I think is wonderful, is you say that the power of speculation, of imagination, is an experience that one can have best of all, perhaps, by reading. So the idea is that more than other experiences we might have, there's something in particular about reading. And I imagine you're also claiming this for ancient readers.
Absolutely.
That when ancient readers read texts, that opened their imagination in some way that other kinds of experiences don't. I think that's something that people in other fields might feel you needed to defend that giant claim.
Well, you know, now we live in such a media-rich world, and so much of the stories that we see or follow are in terms of film or television, and you have visuals. I mean, this is sometimes a commonplace when people talk about film adaptations of novels, is when you read a novel, you're responsible for visualizing what that world is. Whereas my goodness, I think film adaptations can be wonderful and in no way reducing my admiration for them, but it's a different form. And what you see is the directors and all the actors' representation of the story. So, my goodness, I'm thinking this. It's very unclassical in many ways, though not entirely. I just saw and then did it in that order, the film and book, Call Me by My Name.
Right.
And it was very interesting to have that experience. And you could think of many, many different scenes. Of course, by doing it in that order, I already had the visuals from the filmic adaptation. But I guess I'm just meaning that when you're reading, it's left up to you to provide the sounds, the visuals, mm-hmm. to the extent you want to, whereas those at least are provided for you in a film or television adaptation.
No, I totally support this view. So I want to reiterate it because I think it's a very important point. And I find when I teach the same a rich novel to 25 students, they have very individualized imaginations of what the novel means to them. And they see it in very individualized ways. And that there is something that is closed down in a filmic interpretation for the students. Though, I mean, I also like film as well. But
there's still plenty of questions left over for interpretation. It's just somewhat different.
Right, right. Yeah. And people do say that there's something about reading as the way in which we use our brain that is important. Remember, Davis, we did a lot of research on this as well, that we're particularly efficient when we read. And so, therefore, a lot of our brain is free to think about and imagine what we're reading. So I'm very curious, do you think that this also, you can make this claim that this was Virgil's experience as well? How much trouble do you think or difficulty we can get in terms of trying to imagine ancient readers and how they approach text?
Well, one big difference. So though there's some debate exactly when this started, though there's a story about that, is when we read, with very few exceptions, we read silently. Yes. And we read to ourselves. Reading in the ancient world, by and large, was an aural experience. Either you pronounced the words, or more commonly, you actually had a slave, let me be very blunt about it, not just an assistant, but a slave, read the text for you. So you got a text. You didn't get visuals, but you got it in sound.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that – I don't think we could possibly ever say that that was the only way that people read, but that's a very famous difference between them. You know, I think that there's a lot of evidence that you could point to that shows some commonality. There are some books that – and studies of – let me say the I'm going to use reception of literature in a slightly different sense than the historical, but that you respond to literatures. And we have comments by critics. There's a very famous treatise on the sublime, which talks about the response to certain literary passages.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds very familiar.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's a nice idea, that we can imagine these ancient readers in ways that are very similar to us. Now, what you do with that then is you develop the idea of reception history, which means that we try to think about, or you try to imagine also how they look at the text as something that comes with a complicated history. How would you explain to somebody what reception history is if they hadn't heard that term before? So what do we mean when we talk about Virgil's reception history of Homer?
Well, let me just, if you don't mind, talk about reception history more generally before I talk.
Sure.
The rather, in some ways, unusual piece that you've picked up. And so reception history, and by the way, this is in a way how I connect classics and comparative literature. Because in general, when I'm explaining what I do, is I study the tradition of reading the Latin and Greek classics, and many of the our listeners know that for a long period, these were highly prestigious texts and cultures. And so there, within reception history, you could study the history of translations, first transmission, then translation into other languages. If you're a student of ancient drama, for example, you can study the history of the performances.
Right.
And in, you know, recently you can have seen performances of ancient in Ashland. The Shakespeare Festival long ago did a modern adaptation of Euripides' Medea, right, which I didn't unfortunately see, but I wanted to, and set in Los Angeles among an immigrant community. So that kind of adaptation and rewriting and reimagining, or texts that don't even claim to be a translation or adaptation, but nonetheless make reference to those early works. That's all part of reception history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I this begins to get a little more esoteric, but I happen to have been very interested in commentary. So these are scholarly efforts at explaining texts and often used in schools mm-hmm. in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very interested in – was initially interested in looking at those commentaries for evidence of how High Middle Ages read some classic Latin poets.
What they found difficult, just like students turning to a commentary. We all have the idea of commentaries, something that they wanted to get more information on or something they didn't understand or
– Well, and I will also say this is maybe true of many, many scholars. It's certainly true of me. I tend to go to things that are paradoxes or don't make sense to me or where something is out of place. And so to put it somewhat abruptly or crudely, I was interested in how medieval Christian schools were dealing with the poetry of the Roman poet Ovid, which is both, you know, contains all of these pagan myths and quite a bit of racy stories. And I was saying, how did they deal with that? So it was trying to figure out how they used Ovid in their context. So that's commentary, of course, led me to greater and greater reflections of what we can tell about reading and mm-hmm. and thinking by studying commentary.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we're all familiar with the idea of commentaries, and I think it's a very interesting point that what we're looking for in commentaries are unusual moments of conflict. You know, how do commentaries make sense of things? What do they teach us? And we'll come back to that when we talk about some of the other articles. But on this one, the question then is, what can we say in the example, which you say may not be, he may not be the norm, but he's an interesting example. What Virgil knew about or how he approached Homer, the great traditional text he's reading, yeah. in terms of reception history? What did it mean to him? And I think what you're arguing is that he had a way of approaching the scholar, the text. He didn't just take it out of the library, check it out on his own. He read it through a complicated set of commentaries.
So there's something sort of interesting about that article. And that article came into being because I actually wrote a book manuscript, which is to date unpublished, but that's true of a lot of material, but it still might be. And in that, I wrote an interpretation of Virgil's most famous poem, the epic, the Aeneid,
right.
about the founding of Rome by Aeneas, who was an exile from Troy, who escaped from the destruction of Troy. And let's just say I had a very provocative set of readings, which opened up the ambivalences and the ambiguities in Virgil. And it was very funny. I can say this now, and you know this in the world of publishers. I got one reading where, you know, I wondered whether the reviewer was my mother. Because she's coming up a lot in this talk, but it was so positive. And then the other one was, this is the end of all scholarship. This is catastrophe. And so now we'll jump to what the work I do is that it's very important to historicize the text. So the project of looking at how Virgil used Homer is that industry has been going on for over 2,000 years because that Virgil developed his great epic poem on the model, an overt reference to the great Homeric epics. That was part of what the ambitiousness of the program, that was part of the program of honoring Augustus, the new emperor, by setting his story or the story of Rome in a way in the most important epics. So that's long there. But sometimes students, and I mean that at every level, have made the mistake is, oh, if I want to know how Virgil thought about Homer, they would go and read the most by contemporary, I mean today, text of Homer. In the first classes, as we'd say, the Oxford Classical Text,
right.
which is the fruit of centuries of scholarship. It's right. neatly presented there with an apparatus criticus. I can explain all right. of this later if you want. But that is not how the Homer that Virgil had access to. And my argument was that, in fact, if you looked at the debates going on about the interpretation of Homer in Virgil's day, the scholars were debating, did it mean this, did it mean that? And one in the same passage would, if you studied that, and Virgil really did, you would say, well, I don't know what this passage means. Does it mean this? Does mm-hmm. it mean that? And my argument was that, in fact, the ambiguities, the ambivalences, even the uncertainties of Virgil's text could well be rooted in his experience of Homer, which is not just Homer, but Homer outfitted with all of the contemporary scholarship saying this, that, and the other mm-hmm. thing.
So understanding an ancient reader like Virgil, you have to clear your brain out a little bit first from traditions and ideas and versions of text that you may have seen that are much later, and go back and in your own imaginative act, yes. which is the imaginative act of seeing what kind of a text would he have been would he have received at
yes.
that time.
Yes.
And your argument, just to reiterate it again, is that he would have been deeply enmeshed in contemporary arguments about how to read Homer. And that we can have a sense of that. We can, even though that's a long time ago, we can see what it meant to be a contested reader and to have, you know, positions. And we can imagine if we could look at ancient reviews from his time period, there might have been people saying, oh, Virgil got that all wrong, just like people reviewing your book today.
Well, and what I would say that article adds is, and this is a case where I was deeply influenced by a book I read when I was an undergraduate, which very clearly established that Virgil, in his adaptation of Homer, knew and responded to the ancient criticism on Homer. So an ancient critic of the 3rd or 2nd century before the Common Era would have written a commentary on Homer and said, well, Homer said this, but this is, you know, this is very improper. He shouldn't have said this. And then in Virgil's version of the passage, he changes it so that impropriety isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's one level. That was already established. It was very impressive work. And it's one of those books I wish I had written. It was so wonderful. But what's different about my study is that it actually imaginatively thinks of the effect of reading the accumulation of all of these different views.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so what I like to say, and I'll just give you some strange old names, on a given passage, Aristarchus said, well, Homer is not ambiguous. He meant X. Xenodotus comes along and says, I'm not in any doubt, but Aristarchus is wrong. He sent Y. And this was sort of my contribution, is to anyone using the accumulation of these different things, a text that's polyvalent, that's uncertain in its potential meaning, or let's just say has the potential to mean multiple things at the same time, comes into being, produced by the combination of the text plus the commentary.
So it's a wonderful vision of a Homeric text that is very alive.
Yes.
It's a text that's very alive that people are arguing about, and it adds, I really think, a whole new level for to think about a text that's not just simply picking it up, but also seeing how people argued about it at this period, and then how people argued about it, right up to how people arguing about it today. So, but we come to the end of our first segment, so stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back for segment two with Professor Hexter. So stay with us. So we're back for segment two on Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And we're talking with Ralph Hexter about classics and comparative literature. And I want to turn now to another article of yours, this one called Kisses from Juventius, which I think raises a lot of interesting questions for our undergraduates today. And it talks about that sometimes literature from the ancient world was simply too racy for later audiences, in the medieval time period and up to the modern time period as well. And therefore, in terms of what we were talking about, reception, sometimes the text was edited, parts omitted, sent all kinds of changes made. I remember this from my education. And it was funny, I was talking with my husband, and he remembers somebody showing him in class when he was studying at Princeton a part of Catullus that just had dot, 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 dot in it. And they were all kind of like trying to figure out what this dot, dot, dot was. And there were only a small number of people who were trained enough to be able to read what was on the other side of the page there. So
that's an additional reason to learn Latin.
Yes. Good point. Then those people were very happy, the few that could tell everybody else what was on that part. So one of the questions is to talk about what happened in terms of the reception. First, we have Catullus writing homoerotic poetry that was perfectly reasonable at that time period. We don't have any evidence of censorship in that time period, correct?
No.
Okay, so we're talking...
Not at all.
Not at all. So, but what happens then is in later time periods, as ideas change, we see censorship developing. And what one of the interesting points here is that Catullus was unknown until it begins to be discovered. And I just wanted to pause here. I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear a quick footnote here about how something is discovered in the 1300s. If something was not known until then, in my field, we often dig up old texts. But sometimes this may simply be a certain kind of importance given to a text that was otherwise hidden. So I just want to stop for a minute and say, how come something was suddenly shared in the 1300s that it hadn't been before?
I love to talk about this. One of my favorite topics.
Uh-huh.
So let me just remind our listeners that Catullus is a Roman poet earlier than Virgil, from the first half to the middle of the first century of the Common Era. And he wrote lyric poetry of different meters, short forms. And that kind of poetry had a totally different life than, for example, an epic. And Catullus, we know, was known through the later centuries of Rome and even as Rome became Christian. But over the centuries...
He disappeared.
What does disappear mean? Well, the interesting thing about, and this is another thing where the technologies are different. So today, you publish a book, much less put out a tweet or put something on the internet. It's everywhere. It never goes away. Ancient texts had to be laboriously copied and recopied, and the materials on which they were written wore out, sometimes famously, since they were rare and the material was rare, sometimes, not only but particularly during the Christian era, people scraped the old writing off and put another text over them. I won't go further into talking about palimpsests, but that's what those things are called. And now with technology, we can read the undertexts in many cases. In any event, Catullus existed, obviously, otherwise he wasn't be there to be
discovered.
But what was absolutely true before printing was the localization of knowledge. A poem, a work could exist in the manuscript in one monastic library,
and
only a few people in that library would know about it, and possibly no one else in Europe knew about them, and there wasn't the network of communications always to move that about. Now, the more a text was part of a school curriculum, the more widespread it was. So Catullus, we know, I won't go into the details, we can spot a few places where he was. But the interesting thing is that what changed by the 13th century and became even more prominent in the Renaissance over the next couple of centuries is when someone read this text, and let's posit that once a generation, one person was doing that.
Just checking out all of the scrolls in the library.
It earlier times, it may have had very local, maybe even one person read it. At that point, the culture was beginning to change and people were interested in this. And someone said, hey, look what I found. And that really went on in the 15th century massively. So when people they even started to go look to the monasteries to say what texts, particularly from the ancient world, are there that we don't know about. And so that became an industry. But that's how he reentered and became very popular.
But when he does reenter, and it's a wonderful idea that one person read him and then one other person read him, and you know, he survives there sort of like just under the radar, and then he suddenly people become interested in him, and then the copy gets copied and edited and sent out. But what's interesting is that the Catullus that then enters into scholarly debate and discourse is not the same as the Catullus that we had from the ancient world, because it's got pieces missing.
Well, I can give a little bit more nuance to this because I happen to have been very interested in. And in a way, this is a similar question to the one I said motivated me when I went to look at medieval Ovid commentaries. What do they do with the parts that don't fit the contemporary worldview? And so I've been interested, and as a gay man, I'm particularly interested in looking at the history of, you might say, minoritarian sexualities. Mm-hmm. And I've been attuned to that. I had an opportunity to work more or less as an assistant to John Boswell, who was a pathbreaking historian of the history of gay and lesbian culture in Europe. So I looked at the example of Catullus and say one could trace both the silencing and the reemergence. Uh-huh. And what I mean by the silencing is in the 1420s in Pavia, a scholar named Antonio Beccadelli published a two-volume book of epigrams called the Hermaphroditus, which celebrated both male-female and male-male love. I don't believe in that work there was any female-female work, mm-hmm. but that certainly was running around, among other places, in the works of another Roman epigrammatist, Martial. In any event, he published it, but right at his time, people slammed it, said this is immoral, to the point that a few years later, he officially renounced, you know, took it back, as it were. Mm-hmm. So you can see it, the Catullan spirit emerging in full flower, but then getting smashed down. Mm. And what I studied in that article is the fact that basically everyone knows Catullus, who knows Catullus, I'll say, as the celebrator of his erotic relationship with a woman whom he calls by the name Lesbia. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have any connotation of lesbian, but in any event, Lesbia. There are a number of poems in the corpus that celebrate his love for a young man named Juvencius. Mm-hmm. But those are suppressed, and the people who talk about them find ways to denigrate them, to say, oh, well, this is clearly – Catullus was just imitating Greek poems. He didn't have his heart in it. So I'm interested in the ways that the interpretive tradition forces Catullus into a – heterosexual position, forces him to be heteronormative, to use that word. Mm-hmm. And though they can't, there are different tactics. Some editions just don't print the Juvencius right. poems, particularly for schoolboys. But even the ones that do note that they're there find ways of talking them down and saying they're not sincere.
Mm-hmm. So, and you give several examples in the article of people who tried to bring out the homoerotic parts of Catullus, and it didn't work. Again, as you gave that example, and you have other examples of people who were basically bullied or harangued.
Politian is yes, one you're thinking of.
Right, exactly. People who are bullied and harangued into basically taking parts out of the text again.
Well, in the case of Politian, Poliziano, who was one of the most gifted 16th century humanists, and in a work of interpretation, I won't go into all the details, but interestingly, he advanced a reading of the poems of Catullus, which describe his girlfriend Lesbia's pet sparrow. Well, I'll say what it is. The interpretation that he gives is that her pet sparrow. You've read the disclaimer.
Yes.
The pet sparrow is Catullus's penis.
Right.
And the one of the interesting things is this interpretation itself is an ancient one. However, critics of Poliziano
did not like
him. Attack him. And now Poliziano was himself homosexual. And they attack Poliziano in the crudest of terms. I mean, truly disgusting terms. And so I think this is the other part of the subtitle, the policing of the boundaries. And so I was interested in the way that the scholarly world, which is itself connected to the larger world, absolutely, polices even the boundaries of the scholarship on an ancient era.
Mm-hmm. And some of it is simply because material is not considered to be appropriate about sex at all. So there's some of that policing going on. And then within the realm of are you allowed to talk about sexuality with children, some of it is, or young adults, then the homoerotic gay material becomes even more. I think it's interesting you raise the question because people often ask me about whether there's lesbianism in the Bible. And my answer to that in the Hebrew Bible is that sex between two women isn't sex. It doesn't even get included because it isn't even really considered. The sort of the male orientation is very strong. So you see that some things just aren't there because nobody's imagined them, and sometimes you see the repression of it. But then you make the point that all these struggles to try to let the text speak as it spoke in its original historical context, that reading this material, even if you're reading it in a semi-repressed form, can be a liberatory experience for people, and that they are able to just see the world a little differently by picking up these texts.
Certainly that is a tradition that interests me because, you know, I'm going to speak in generalities, but though the views of, let me just say, male-male relationships were different in the ancient world,
yes,
there was not a uniform ban on it. There certainly were very negative opinions about individuals who took the so-called passive role that was regarded as a violation of masculine norms. Nevertheless, it was totally expected that people who were slaves took that role, and there was sort of no moral disapprobation of them. In any event, we know very, very well that from just generally in the Christian world and subsequently, that was a very, very different view of same-sex relations.
Right.
And the thing that fascinates me, because classical Latin and Greek texts have such a high cultural value, they couldn't entirely dismiss that. So they had to come to grips with it in commentaries. I don't know if you know the film Morris, I'm blanking on the name, my goodness,
Forster.
Forster, yes. And that wonderful line when they're translating Plato, and the tutor says, "Omit the unspeakable vice of the Greeks."
Right.
You know, just
right,
don't even say it.
Yes.
But
yes,
that's there. And for people who might have had different views, this is now my imagination projected back over generations of readers, those texts were very important because they provided a liberatory space.
Uh-huh.
And translations, commentaries also provided a liberatory space because you could discuss a topic that would otherwise have been out of bounds. But if you're interpreting Plato or Catullus or Martial or Virgil, you have a license to talk about something that you could not do otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And I think your point is just wonderful about the high valuation of the classics. I mean, everybody holds them up as the place where you go to sort of have the high level culture. But then you have that moment of paradox where there are things in there that aren't the same as the values at the context in which they're being read. You see that struggle being fought out. But I really want to emphasize this point because I think it's very important for those of us who teach in a university about the idea, about the liberatory capacity of reading. So I think that that's something we may underestimate when we put together and we put together a syllabus, we're often thinking about what we can cover as opposed to what might liberate our students. What is the act, give them a capacity to see themselves in the world and in a different way. So I just wanted to, you know, think with you for a little bit, for a minute, about that role and how important that is. Central, of course, to the humanities in general, where it's an opportunity for students to simply, it may be a little bit uncomfortable even at times, but to see the world a little differently, and that act of freeing that happens.
To see the world differently, and then it's so often different from the sense of the world we have that we receive from the media. I mean, we all experience what the world expects of us, the norms, and they are so powerful. We know that that is a lot of the pressure on individuals. But I think particularly for students, whether it's in K through 12 or certainly in college, it's so liberating to realize that different times and different places, different cultures had totally different ways of looking at reality, totally different norms. Not just the norms, but the opportunities. If you look back at, my goodness, the ancient world, people point this out, it is not a model, a social model that we want to follow. There are many ways in which, for many individuals, they were entirely oppressed and suppressed. You know, we talk about classical Athens. Well, slavery. Classical Athens was fine up to a point if you were a male citizen of Athens, and if you were going to indulge in sex other than with your wife, you better take the so-called masculine role. Then you were fine. But for women, for slaves, very bad, to say the least. And yet there were, I think the idea is that every society has limitations and liberations. And the basic point is to realize that other societies constructed those differences. For example, one of the points I always make about the ancient world is that really the most important difference, I'll take it for Rome, the most important thing is something we hardly think of in modern America, which is status. That is, are you a free person? Are you a slave? Or were you a slave?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, and are you freed? Mm-hmm. Someone who had been emancipated from slavery. Mm-hmm. And the category of slave did not map at all onto any racial category.
Mm-hmm. So it's a different way of organizing the social structure.
Exactly.
And again, what you're saying is that there's something that's liberatory just about seeing the world is so different in different times, even if it's not necessarily one that you want to adopt, just the idea of difference. But I'm curious whether you would still argue today that there's something liberatory about the classics in particular. Clearly the issue of the homoerotic, the capacity to of gay sexuality is terribly important. But I'm wondering, beyond that, do you think the classics fill a role in a special way, either because they're either very old or because there is something about the way in which their reception history is so important, so you take your place in a very long chain of readers?
Well, there are a couple different things that I think you've combined there. So, you know, today, again, when, you know, there was this saying that the past is another country. The idea of study the past, it's different. I'm actually, I now put a change on that, given the fact that the power of commercialism, of media. I mean, you can buy Nike shoes everywhere in the world. So what I say now is the past is the only other country or the only foreign country.
Uh-huh,
because you couldn't buy Nike shoes in the Agora, in the marketplace in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually think you have to go back to pre-modern formations to actually see something sufficiently different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do not know enough about the ancient literatures of other cultures for me to make the claim that the Greco-Roman classics are particularly liberatory. And in fact, that's a sort of noxious view in itself.
Mm.
It subtends the whole Western Eurocentric view. So I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
But now, I think that there are, from what I've read, there are incredible dialogue to be had with the authors. For example, I just taught a class last quarter on the figure of Socrates, and we read two dialogues by Plato and a play by Aristophanes. And I think there's a lot of wonderful thought in that.
Well, you know, someone like Iris Murdoch would argue that there is a special value to at least to Greek tragedy, because saying that it's the most grim adult literature that was ever written in the history of the world, that there's a kind of a willingness to look at a kind of darkness that you found then and that you didn't necessarily find in the retreat of the centuries afterwards. I've always found that an interesting argument to make. So we would have to have a whole other show to see whether or not to discuss about the values of classics. And I certainly understand your point that the classics is also used today for many right-wing groups as a way of trying to assert certain kinds of, as you say, normative values and attitudes towards women in particular is certainly found a lot on the internet. Yeah. So like, you're moving in dangerous shores in some ways.
You know, to your point, one of the things I do like about, as someone who studies a number of European languages and cultures and the classics, yes, because of the great almost the monopoly that the Greco-Roman world had on that, those cultures, along with Judeo-Christian religion, is when you take up any of those texts, you can enter into a dialogue. If you take up Virgil, you can enter into dialogue with St. Augustine, with Dante,
yes,
with Goethe, you name it. It's a wonderful party game. It's great mm-hmm. to be in that world. However, you know, I have colleagues who study the subcontinent, the traditions from India, mm-hmm. from China. And I know that, in fact, if you read into those traditions, you can be involved in those dialogues as well. So I'm a little loath. I don't know enough to say what's special about it. And I'm extremely reluctant because, as we've said, of the bad arguments that have been born out of that.
Absolutely. And that those could be dangerous bedfellows for right now. So, well, what we only have a little bit of time left, but what I want to do is turn to another large topic, which I think will be interesting to introduce our listeners to, which they probably have never thought about in general, which is from your article on Ovid, the different ways in which works are attributed to people who didn't necessarily write them. And I think we're all vaguely aware that that happens. You know, we all sort of know about that. But the complexity that we find with the tradition that you talk about, where we find famous scholars, famous writers, who many, many other texts that they didn't write become associated with their names. And similarly, in biblical material, there's 5 books of Moses, then there's 6 books, then there's 8 books of Moses. And I thought it would be very worthwhile to try to differentiate for people, just give them a little bit of a sense about how do you talk about different ways of having false literature. Many people have heard of terms like forgery, but you make it very clear that a forgery is one very particular kind of a fake document. And then we have something called a false author. And then we have something called pseudepigraphy, which a fancy word, which means false writings, which would mean something that was attributed to somebody that they didn't write. And this seems like a bewildering forest of ideas, how we can differentiate. So in the case of Ovid, what you're saying is that we start off with something that you would you call just imitation, where people, there was a value to writing like somebody, and you copy them in the ancient world in a way we don't necessarily understand, but that's something just about a value. It was a social value. That might be a place for us to start.
That would be a good place to start. And I'm, you know, it's interesting that you picked up on that article because it's a somewhat esoteric topic. And, you know, it is actually very much on my mind because I'm on the verge of publishing with 2 co-editors a collection of these pseudo Ovidiana. These are poems from the late antique and medieval world that are not by the Roman poet Ovid, but that circulated under his name. So this is this first time that this collection has been brought together, and we'll do it with English translations. But what is interesting is that there are different motivations. And to your point about imitation is – and this may be a little bit of a an express history, but we are so committed to the idea that literature should be the expression of originality and sincerity.
Yes.
And sometimes that is, it's supposedly invented by Wordsworth. I think that's a little overstated, but it is a relatively modern value. And the entire history of education and learning to write either prose or poetry was based on imitation. So again, there were lines which you weren't to cross because then you would be a plagiarist.
Right.
You know, you would be a thief. But people, like we started talking about Virgil. Virgil imitates Homer.
Right.
He does it in such a masterful way that that it is an honor to him and not a discredit.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not that esoteric a topic. Maybe a lot of our listeners have not worried about what Ovid wrote, but a lot of our listeners may have worried about the Gospels. And
indeed.
Exactly.
Well, and also the letters of Paul, which I'm not a specialist in, but there are a number of letters of Paul in the canonical Christian Bible that most scholars would say are clearly not written by Paul himself.
Exactly. So if our first point was one which I think is sets up a very nice contrast between the ancient world and the world today, that originality was not the most important thing, and that so imitation and the idea you mentioned that an author would be highly valued for being accomplished but not necessarily for originality, that's came up when we've done some interviews in the past. I've talked with people about, for example, the history of Chinese poetry and other kinds of traditions where there is imitation and copying and originality isn't always the most important thing. Then we go to the second point, which gets a little closer to the gospel issue, which is already in the ancient world, people were beginning to differentiate between texts that seemed to be written by the person who they're attributed to and other texts which did not appear to be written by those people. So we've already got going on in our reception history these kinds of debates in the ancient world.
Well, in any one of a number of areas, you have people who are recognized as authorities. This is true in philosophy. It's true in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It's true in various religious traditions. And given the fact that, let's say, you have a prophet or someone who claims to have special knowledge, other people of that group want to present texts with the greatest authority possible, so they circulate it under the name of that author.
Exactly.
And I would say, you know, one of the things that I steer clear of because it's so hard to reconstruct is the actual intentionality of, well, not only an author, but certainly these whoever was behind these pseudonymous texts. I will say, someone I'm working with, my postdoc, Justin Haynes, while working with me on these texts, has come up with a very convincing argument. He's identified the author of one of the texts. I'm not going to announce it in advance. It's under consideration for publication.
Okay.
You can talk to him later.
We'll have to have him on the show.
But, you know, it's very interesting because if this is true, we actually know what this person's motivation was. And, you know, I think another thing, two more things on this. You did talk about, I think you called it a false author. I think I would call it a fictional author. There are people who will write fictions and make an author be the author of that fiction. But that's a very literary game. And, you know, I will say, you mentioned forgery. Forgeries are usually have a very specific purpose.
Yes.
And often, say in the world of art, forgeries are intended to make a painting of no value into something that someone will spend lots of money for.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about forging money. It's counterfeiting.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you know, in the days of – in the era of fake news, look how many forgeries there are, even – forged videos, people that, you know, things that are being circulated.
False photos
that are intended to cast someone in a very negative light or make it appear that they said X, Y, or Z or did X, Y, or Z when they didn't. So, you know, pseudepigrapha and et cetera are very much with us.
Mm-hmm. And so if we look now and we turn to pivoting to the future, do you think that now the kind of repression that we talked about of the homoerotic material and classics as you think in the future, has that pretty much over, do you think? Do you think we're in a time where ancient texts speak much more closely to how they were read and understood, or at least, you know, presented in the ancient world? Maybe this is a difficult thing to say today because we're in the midst of a complex political situation. But just as a classicist looking into the future, I'm curious what you think about the next sort of generation of scholarship, which presumably won't be having to repeat the last 100 years of struggling around the freeing of the homoerotic gay material that comes down to us from the classics.
I hope not. But, you know, I can't remember exactly what book it was, but Oxford University Press has its books published in many different places. And there was a book, and there are a number of different things on different topics, that a number of works I could think of where the workers or the people in a Muslim country like Indonesia, mm-hmm. or in India refused to publish the book, mm-hmm. and refused to allow its circulation. So I would say one of the paradoxes, a couple times I've referred to the fact that material is everywhere now. I think we have to be reminded that this space, which is utopian from certain regards in Western Europe and North America and a number of other countries scattered around the world, there may be advanced. You could track where same-sex marriage is being allowed.
Right.
But at the same time, there are many places around the world which now have access to those materials, which where there's violent response to that, where that is regarded, even if this is historically inaccurate, regarded as a Western importation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, given, you know, I have to say I'm less sanguine than I would have been 15 or 20 years about this. So yes. I think that we have to work very hard to maintain that liberatory space, mm-hmm. and make sure that we keep defending it and doing the good work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a wonderful note to end on. Let's go out. Let's defend that liberatory space. I think that sounds like a great call to end Office Hour on. And I want to thank you very much for coming on the show. This is Ralph Hexter from Classics and Complet. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. And to remind you that if you want to listen to the show again or you want to listen to another show from the past, our archives are available at OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com. That's OfficeHourUCDPodcast.com, and this show will be up there soon. And we hope that you come back next week, and we're going to knock on somebody else's door. So until then, go out and do some liberatory reading.